from May 23rd to May 28th, taking place in various venues in North and Northeast Portland. More information about the festival, including specific performances, screenings, dates, times, and venues, can be found at kvoo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock in the a.m. coming up on Veterans Voice, taking on the human costs of war. At 10, Valley Views talks to the director of the Corvallis Bike Collective about the services they provide and the upcoming neighborhood street party. We'll round out the hour with flashpoints, generously shared with us by our siblings in struggle at KPFA in Berkeley. And we'll finish up the morning starting at 11 with On the Ground Radio, looking at the convergence of the movements for Palestinian human rights and for Black Lives. That all happens because of the support of the KBOO community, and we thank you. If you are not yet a member of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight soon at kboo.fm. Click on the word donate. Or why don't you give my friend Michelle a call at the front desk at 503-231-8032. And now, Veterans Voice.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, and 104.3 FM Corvallis and Albany. And you can hear KBOO on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. And if you want to hear some of our older shows, you can go there also, kboo.fm/Veterans Voice. I'm Marvin, and Mike should be back today. He's been down in Nicaragua, in Managua, Nicaragua, helping our brother peace veteran and peace activist, Brian Wilson, who had to have an operation. And Mike went down to Nicaragua to help him out a little bit. He should be back soon. And Angie is still up in Olympia. She's going to be going on a really interesting, she's going back to the University of Notre Dame, I think May 21st through the 24th. They're having a war resistors symposium back in at Notre Dame, and she's going to be part of it. And that's really wonderful thing to do. I miss them both, and I'll be glad when they come back. But I got you, the listeners, and that makes it a lot easier. Like Sam said, you know, you can join our wonderful family here at KBOO by going and join us. You can do that on the internet at kboo.fm, or you can come down to the station and donate with donate down here. With the craziness that's going on with the Trump regime, you know, KBOO is going to become more and more important as things keep going the way they have been. I didn't get a chance to interview my friend Joe Lewis earlier this month because on May 4th, 1970, the Ohio National Guard opened fire for 13 seconds. They fired 67 rounds of live ammunition from high-powered rifles into the students at Kent State, and they murdered 4 students and they wounded 9 others. They murdered Jeffrey Miller, who was 20 years old. They murdered Allison Krauss. She was 19 years old. They murdered William Schroeder, who was 19. And they murdered Sandra Schuer. She was 20. You know, and that's the average age of us guys in Vietnam, you know, 19, 20-year-old kids. And they turned their rifles on them, and they murdered these students. And like I said, they wounded 9 others, including my friend Joe Lewis. And Joe was pretty young. I think he was 19 at the time. And he was 71 feet away from these soldiers of the National Guard, Ohio National Guard, when they turned and they fired at him. And they wounded him twice in his left, I think right abdomen, and they shot him in his lower leg. And Joe still has trouble to this day on having problems from having been shot. And I miss Joe a lot. And I see his stuff on Facebook. And he sends me messages here after the show and different things. He's a wonderful guy. And also, our good buddy Jim Russell was also shot at Kent State. He was shot, I believe, in the leg or the buttock. And he got shotgun pellets, I think, to his face. He passed away a few years back, and they both lived over in the Scappoose, St. Helens area. And Jim passed away, and it's a big loss that we lost Jim. I want to have Sam play this song that I play every time on this time. And go ahead, Sam. Can you start it? It's Ohio. There you go. Soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own.
soldiers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming. Forget in Ohio. 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 I'm an import. Forget in Ohio. Forget in Ohio. Forget in Ohio. Forget in Ohio. Forget in Ohio.
That's for my buddy Joe Lewis. And you know, I think about what they do to people around the world with these weapons that we sell. I think we're still the number one, not we, but the government is the number one weapons dealer in the world. And I thought about, you know, what's happened to our brothers and sisters in Palestine. What was it, 111 have been murdered by, you know, the Israeli IDF forces, and I don't know how many were been wounded. I was sitting at a coffee house that I like to go to, and I picked up the New York Times, and on the front page, it was just a picture of, I think it was five or six Palestinian women, and one of them was holding a baby that had been killed. And that just sent me right back to Vietnam, you know, which, you know, that happened a lot. But, you know, something else really just really bothered me a lot about what's happening to our brothers and sisters in Palestine. And I watched these pictures of Trump's daughter and his son-in-law and all those folks at this opening that embassy in Jerusalem, and here they are in these beautiful clothes, and they're having the best food and just having a wonderful, great time, you know. And not far away from them is the Palestinians being murdered, you know. And I just got so angry when I saw that, and the decadence of what was happening in that embassy compared to what was happening to people in Palestine. And it just still bothers me. I want to, today, you know, we do a lot of on this show, and we've done quite a few shows with our sister veterans, and most of the ones on Vietnam were mostly about the nurses in Vietnam and what wonderful job they did and how they've really suffered, you know, when they've came back, a lot of them. And I have two really good friends that were nurses in Vietnam. And but there were more than just the women that was nurses. There were a few that were like clerks and different things like that. But also there were other women in that war. You know, there were reporters. There was a book written, and we interviewed this woman, man, it must have been 10, 15 years ago, called Even the Women Must Fight. It was about the Viet Cong women in the South. And I believe it was the North Vietnamese women who had gone south to you know, support their the troops in the South that came down from the North. And I know quite a few of those women from my time being in going back to Vietnam. And Laurel and I spent time there. And Laurel was working on a book before she passed away that was dealing with women who had gone from the North down to the South to entertain their troops, you know, like there were dancers and singers and actors, actresses, and all kinds of things. And she was going to write a book about that, and it's sad that she never got to do that. But I'm going to read some today out of article that was in this magazine that I read, and it's called Courageous Women, Experience of the Women on the Front Lines in their roles in the war in Vietnam. And I'm not going to talk, it's not about women who were American nurses, and bless each one of those nurses, you know, and the medics and the doctors and the helicopter pilots that came and took our wounded out, and they, you know, and bless every one of them, and we supported them a lot. In this article, there's a, let me get back on where I'm supposed to be. There was an Army nurse. I just want to mention her because she's pretty interesting. Her name was Linda Van Devanter. She was an Army nurse in Vietnam, and she wrote a book, and it was pretty well publicized. And she was very, very interesting. In fact, she was in the she worked at the hospital up in the Central Highlands in Pleiku, an area that I was in, and she was there at the same time that I was in, but she was a different division, I believe. She wasn't a division, she was something else. But in this article, there's two other women that I thought was really interesting, and I'm going to read about it. One of them was Zhang Tui Cham. She was a communist field surgeon from the north that came down to the south. And the thing about Linda, I was going to go back, she passed away pretty young. She was pretty young when she died. And then the other one is Kate Webb. She was a journalist from New Zealand who was working for a newspaper from Australia. And the pictures of both these women is just amazing. I'd read about Dr. Tram before, but I hadn't heard anything about this woman, Kate Webb, until I read this article, and it was just very, very interesting about both these women. And I'm going to read some here to start out with. I think I want to start with Dr. Tram. And on January 1st, 1969, Dr. Tram recorded in her diary a message to Ho Chi Minh had sent about a message Ho Chi Minh had sent to the fighting for the communist cause. This year, greater victories are assured at the battlefront for independence, for freedom. Fight until the Americans leave. Fight until the puppets fall. Advance, soldiers, patriots, North and South, reunited. No other spring more joyous. And Tram had thoughts, had thought of little else since December 23rd, 1966, when she left her family in Hanoi and began the dangerous trek down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And the Ho Chi Minh Trail, it sounds like something big, but it's at that time it was small trails through the jungles, through the mountains, and across rivers, and it was a very dangerous thing that these people went through to get to the south. When she left her family in Hanoi and began the dangerous trek down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, 3 months later, she reached Duc Pho. And Duc Pho was where my cousin Bill was, and he got there in late 69, and he was at Duc Pho. Well, that's where his base camp. He was a field medic, a combat medic. And also our good friend Don Mills was stationed at Duc Pho, and I believe he was there in 68, 69. And a district in the south central Quang Nai province. The people there had heavily resisted the French during the First Indochina War and were now fighting the Americans and South Vietnamese forces. Tram was assigned the job of chief surgeon at Duc Pho Clinic, working to save Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers. While Tram derived great satisfaction from her work, she was troubled by the thwarted attempts to be accepted into the party. She wasn't being able to join the Communist Party. Tram believed that being a party member would allow her more effective service to the cause. To her great frustration and sorrow, traumas, educated background branded her as bourgeoisie, that is middle class and the materialist, and therefore unworthy of membership into the party. Tram dedicated medical work and obvious devotion to the cause, however, eventually gained the respect of the Communist Party leaders. And on September 28, 1968, she was finally accepted, writing in her diary, "My dearest feelings today that I must struggle to deserve the title of communist." During her service, Tram found it difficult to not befriend the young men fighting for the Vietnamese unity. "I have a physician's responsibility and should maintain some degrees of objectivity," she wrote, "but I cannot keep my professional compassion for my patients from becoming affection towards them, something that ties them to me and makes them feel very close to me." In the other stories about her, she not only worked on North and South, the North soldiers and the Viet Cong soldiers, she also worked on the people around that area, and she also helped South Vietnamese soldiers that had been wounded. So she was, you know, she was working on everybody to make them better, you know. In late March 69, she transferred to a clinic that treated civilians and military cases. Americans considered the area a free fire zone, an area with supposedly no friendly civilians, so anyone remaining was considered an enemy and could be fired upon. Those were very dangerous areas. Whenever American units approached, clinic personnel had to flee. They were never really safe, and throughout the summer, the medics and their wounded were constantly on the move as the intense fighting grew closer and closer. On July 16th, Tram witnessed a nearby airstrike where each bomb strike, fire and smoke flared up. The napalm bomb flashes, then explodes in the red ball of fire, leaving dark, thick smoke that climbs into the sky. And napalm, we've talked about napalm before, and it's a jelly, and it's on fire, and boy, it's just almost impossible to put out. If it gets on your skin, it just burns everything. It's really a horrible, horrible thing. During such raids, Trump worried about the people she knew and loved. "From the positions nearby, I sit with silent fury in my heart," she wrote. "Who is burned in that fire and smoke? In those heaven-shaking explosion, whose bodies are annihilated in the bomb craters? Oh, may heroic people, perhaps no one on earth has suffered more than you." From underground shelters and bunkers, Trump had heard American truth but never encountered them face to face. Sent on a nightmare emergency mission, she once walked through the hostile territory with an armed guard. "Perhaps I'll meet the enemy and perhaps I will fall, but I'll hold my medical bag firmly regardless," she wrote in her diary. The diary is really interesting. If you ever get the chance, you should read that diary. On June 2nd, 1970, Tram's clinic took a direct hit, which killed five patients. 10 days later, American troops attacked the medics at a different location. No one was injured, but the medics had to move away again. A few days later, Tram and two Vietnamese civilians were walking on a trail with a soldier when she came face to face with a group of Americans. Local villagers later found her body, and she had been shot in the head. Tram's diary fell into the hands of Fred Whitehurst, an American working with the military intelligence unit assigned to destroy enemy documents. Whitehurst was about to throw the diaries in the fire when his Southern Vietnamese interpreter, Sergeant Nguyen Hughes, stopped him. "Don't burn that, Fred," he said. "It has fire in it already." Nguyen read aloud the entries to Whitehurst and was moved and kept the diaries when he left Vietnam in 1972. In 2005, Whitehurst located Tram's family and gave them the diaries. Later that year, they were published in Hanoi as one volume, which became a bestseller. Young Vietnamese readers who had learned about the war only from textbooks or overly formal diaries were taken by Tram's unpretentious voice, describing a warm, intelligent, and occasionally self-doubting young person caught up in the horrors of war. In 2007, Tram's diary, Tram's diary was translated into English and published under the title Last Night I Dreamed of Peace. And if you ever get the chance, you should really read that diary. It's really, really amazing, amazing diary. And when I was living in Hanoi with Lorelle, was teaching at the university in Hanoi, I would go to this publishing company and I would help edit books that were written by these folks, you know, that went down south to support the troops and to fight down in the south. And there were some really, really interesting stories, you know. And I got, I, as I read these things and edited them and everything, and man, those young soldiers and people who went down that trail, they were no different than us guys, you know. We were all very young, and they were very young too, and just we were put in a very bad situation, you know, of a war. And Sam, I think I want you to play that next song for me, and.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds. People gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run.
That's a wonderful song by Tracy Chapman. The first song I want to talk about a little bit, Yellow River, that's about a Civil War soldier who was getting to go home after fighting for so long. And he was finally getting to go home and see his family. And he was, you know, he's putting his rifle down. He's had it, you know, and one line when he says he still hears the cannon fire in his brain, you know, in his mind, which happens to all of us that's been to war. We always have that in our brains, in our minds, the sound of these filthy, filthy wars that are fought, you know. And, this, of course, the second one, Ohio about our, you know, the brothers and sisters that were killed at Ohio State. And then this one by Tracy Chapman, which really, really talks about what's going on in this country. This country is just, you know, that our wealth is just going to the top of the pile and taken away from the rest of us. And it's just going higher and higher up, and we're getting less and less and less, you know, and people, you know, are afraid they're going to lose what they have. And they go after the wrong people, you know. They go after the poor people, and they go after, you know, people that they shouldn't, you know. They should be angry at the people at the top that are taking everything from us. And, you know, like Tracy Chapman says, you know, the tables are going to turn. And we've got to all be together. We all got to stick together and take care of each other. And Tracy's got it right, you know. And now I'm going to read the story about the Kate Webb, the journalist from New Zealand who was working for an Australian company. In March 19, this picture of her is just really interesting. She's got really short hair, not real short, but she's wearing an army shirt, a jungle shirt. She has a pin stuck in her pocket. She's got a notebook. She has a cigarette in her left hand, a pin in her right hand, and she's talking to this Vietnamese guy, and she's just got this look on her face of such intenseness. She's looking, she's very young. In March 1967, Kate Webb left the newsroom job in Sydney, Australia, and headed for Vietnam. It was simply the biggest story going, and I didn't understand it. The 23-year-old New Zealand-born journalist says, so she was only 23. After a few weeks of writing articles for Vietnamese newspapers, Webb got a freelance job with a GI newspaper. This widened her options, giving her formal accreditations with the Military Assistant Command Vietnam, or MACV, which oversaw all U.S. combat troops in South Vietnam, an extended visa, access to daily military briefings, and the right to accompany men into battle. On January 30th, 1968, Webb rushed to the besieged U.S. embassy in Saigon to cover the communist Tet Offensive, becoming the first wire correspondent to do so. Her articles appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, and Time magazine. Webb discovered that she possessed a crucial trait for a war correspondent, the ability to function and write amid the knife edges near the battles. Webb's curiosity eventually led her to Cambodia, where the U.S. Air Force was covertly bombing North Vietnamese and Viet Cong sanctuaries. Because we did a story on that before about the bombing of that area in the Plain of Jars and all over that area. And those areas are still, Cambodia and Laos, are just full of anti-personnel landmines and unexploded ordnance. It's just people are, you know, even in Vietnam, they're still being blown up by all this stuff we left behind. Okay. On March 18th, 1970, Cambodian Prime Minister Lan Nol deposed Prime Minister Norodom Sihanouk and allied himself with the United States. But Lan Nol had to contend with an enemy within the country, the Khmer Rouge, Cambodian's communists led by the brutal Pol Pot, and they were brutal. On the night of April 6, 1971, Che Ho, a Cambodian freelance reporter, told Webb that Cambodian paratroopers were likely to clash with North Vietnamese soldiers along Highway 4 the following day. Taking with her a Cambodian translator, Chim Sarat, Webb drove to the rear lines and continued on foot, hoping to report firsthand stories from the front. A half hour later, gunfire seemed to burst from all sides, forcing Webb and Surratt to seek cover in a roadside ditch. They huddled there alongside four other non-combatants. Once the fight was over, the civilians tried to quickly move away from the area. But later that morning, they came face to face with two young North Vietnamese soldiers who motioned for them to drop everything. Terrified, their hands in the air, the civilians all cried out, "Ne Bao," journalists, and "Nuk." They wanted water. "Nuk" is water in Vietnamese. The soldiers stripped the civilians of their belongings, tied their hands behind them with baling wire that cut into their skin, linked them into two groups of three, and moved them into the dark bunker. Webb feared a live grenade would follow. But instead, the soldiers forced the group to march. I tasted it, the fling of being a prisoner, underneath the burning thirst, the new loneliness in me, Webb wrote. And although she felt certain they would be killed, she couldn't resist her reporter's compulsive documenting of every detail of her experience. So she's still a reporter, no matter if she was a captive. After a blurred number of days and nights on foot, the prisoners and their captors stopped in a clearing. One by one, the soldiers singled out each prisoner for what they said were interviews. They took Webb to a military man who was in his 60s, sitting before him, her hands shook in fear. "Don't be afraid," the interpreter said. "You are in the hands of the Liberation Armed Forces, the Army of South Vietnamese, the Viet Cong." He told Webb to speak slowly so he could understand her English. She's Australian, and I'll tell you a story about that. An odd thing happened as questions followed questions as the young interpreter struggled to translate from English, she wrote later. "I found myself thinking of the senior officer interrogating me as a professional soldier. The flip side of that was that I stopped feeling like a filthy, scared prisoner and like a professional reporter instead. He was taking what the war dealt out to him, and I was taking what the war dealt out to me." After several days with little rest and food, the prisoners were in poor health. They had lost too much weight, and Webb had experienced severe symptoms, vomiting, diarrhea, fever, and shivering. But she felt more disturbed by her mental state. Living inside the gray limbo of a prisoner with no links to the living world made her fear she was quickly descending into a dark place. Finally, following a tense new round of interrogations at the same location, the soldiers told the prisoners they were being released. Webb didn't allow herself to believe it. Hope we had fast learned was the treacherous as the Oasis image, and it's cruel because they were told before that they were going to be released, and then they didn't get released, and so. After 2 days, Webb woke in the middle of the night and saw the others scrambling together their things. Amid hasty goodbye handshakes, the guards left their prisoners alone in the dark on the roadside in no man's land. So they just released them. Terrified, they began walking and soon saw a group of Lon Nol soldiers. Webb waved a white cloth and they all repeated, "Kesat, Kesat, Kesat," which was press. They had been in captivity for 23 days. As Webb recovered from two types of malaria, her transition from captivity to freedom had perhaps the strangest and in some ways the most difficult aspect of her experience. She found quite disturbing the deeply divided American press. Webb was shocked when, speaking to the members of the Washington Press Club, she was told that a field reporter was morally bound to take the pro-war or pro-peace side. Webb argued that a field reporter's job was not to choose sides, but only to report what was happening and what people were saying, feeling, and doing on the ground. Without that hard, unbiased input, she said, there was nothing to opinionate or to stand on. On May 3rd, 2003, Webb died of cancer in Sydney at the age of 64. The New York Times obituary quoted a fellow Vietnam reporter, Pulitzer Prize-winning Peter Arnett, who honored Webb as a fearless action reporter, one of the earliest and yet women correspondents of the Vietnam War. So all three of these women died early ages. The doctor, she was really young, and this reporter, she was very young. And then the nurse, the American nurse, she was really young too. And they all died. I think the nurse died of cancer also, if I remember right, from cancer, which is, you know, not only is devastating thing, but both of those women probably got, you know, their cancer from being exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam, and Agent Orange is just a terrible thing that they use to spray the jungles and to kill the foliage so people couldn't, you know, the Viet Cong couldn't hide and different things like that. When I was reading that they were that she was having trouble talking to it, like her Australian accent, I remember being we were down in Hue in the central part of Vietnam, and Laurel was teaching at the School of Pedagogy in Hue, right on the Perfume River. And me and Don Blackburn, who was living in Vietnam at that time, were walking around. We were getting ready to cross the bridge that goes from one side of Hue to the other side, where the Citadel and all that is, when the Battle of Hue is where the center part of that battle was at the Citadel. If you go onto the internet, you can look up Hue, H-U-E, and look at the Citadel when it was during the Battle of Hue and what it looks like now. And it's very, very interesting. But as we were walking, we had just finished talking to Laurel, and we decided, you know, let's go across the river, and we was going to go have some lunch to eat. And there was this family. The father was probably in his 30s, 35, and the wife was about the same age. They had two children. And so we stopped and said hello. And as soon as they spoke, they're Australians. And we were talking to them. They were there on vacation, and I asked the children, you know. I asked the parents, said they were having a good time. It was really interesting. They had heard about the war, and they wanted to see what Vietnam was like now. And so they decided to come and visit Vietnam. They're having a great time. And I asked the kids, you know, well, how do you like it? Are you having fun? No, don't like the food. It's too hot. We traveled too much and stuff. You know, I said, you got to take in the culture. You know, you guys are going to go to the Citadel and see it. You're going to see a lot of history. And they finally, yeah. And the kid said something. I said, sorry, I didn't really understand you. Because of your accent. And he says, my accent? Yank, you've got a really bad accent. And so I thought, you know, wow, look at that. Here I am being, you know, thinking, here I'm an American. And it was just really funny. But Australia had a lot of soldiers in Vietnam, too. They had combat units in Vietnam. And they didn't lose as many soldiers as we did. They were basically around the Saigon area. They did a lot of intelligence stuff. They had infantry units. But they also suffered a lot of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, on their soldiers when they got back to Australia. There's a really good song. I was only 19. I've played it on this show before, and it talks about this young soldier who was sent to Vietnam, and about his problems with when he got back, you know, sleep problems, his skin problems. He couldn't get a job. He couldn't sleep. And one of the things he talks about in his song is when the medical helicopters would take off and fly, he would automatically think and just slip right back into Vietnam for the medevac helicopters, you know. And so that never, ever, ever goes away. And these people, you know, who are in the wars now, they're coming back and they're having the same things that we had from Vietnam. I deal a lot every day, almost every day. I talk to veterans from the Gulf Wars, and boy, they're having the same problems that us guys had. And the women, the female veterans from those wars are too. They're having a lot of trouble. They're having lots of divorces. They're having alcohol problems. Some of the women have had drug problems, having a hard time getting jobs, just like us guys. And one of the things that they talk about a lot is the medical care from the VA, from the Veterans Administration, up on the Hill here in Portland. And a lot of them suffer for military sexual trauma from being in the military and being harassed or attempted rape or rape. And they have a problem with going to male doctors. And so the hospital up on the Hill did have a clinic for only our sister veterans, and the nurses and the doctors were women. But the problem is there wasn't enough of these doctors, women doctors and women nurses, to help these women. And so sometimes they would have to go to a male doctor, and some of them didn't really like doing that. So they wouldn't, you know, they just kind of quit going up on the Hill. And one of the something else that our sisters were having a problem with, the VA doesn't have anything for births. So these women would become pregnant and needed, you know, to have their babies, they would be sent to a different hospital, you know, instead of the VA hospital, which is our hospital, you know, that takes care of us. It isn't just a male veterans hospital. It's all of us, including our sisters. So that needs to be taken care of for our sisters. But I was, you know, the more I talked to the women and these young, the guys coming from these wars, and the bitterness that a lot of them feel, you know, and the sadness in their voices. And I was walking in, I was in Cornelius, I think, and I was crossing a road, and there was a young man sitting in a car, a real hot rod car he had bought, you know, and as I was walking across the street, the light was green, red for him, and I said, "Nice car." And I said, "What size of motor it has?" And he said, "Oh, the biggest I could get, the fastest I could get." And I says, "Yeah, I did the same thing when I came back from Vietnam. I bought a 1969 Chevelle SS 396, the biggest, fastest car I could buy." And he says, "I bought this when I came back from Afghanistan." I says, "I know you did." And it was just so interesting, the things between us that never changes from these wars. And I got a message from Stephanie Mulligan, who was our stage director and when we did our plays in Vietnam, Midsummer Night's Dream, and one boy, my throat, and one of the actors that was in it, Doug Miller, passed away. He had cancer of his liver, and he passed away. And I was just thinking back when I heard that Stephanie put that out, that Doug had died, and he was young. And I just start thinking back about all the guys who served in Vietnam who died of liver cancer and different things. And one of the things from Agent Orange is goes after the livers, because the liver tries to get rid of all that dioxin out of it. And the kidneys and the livers in veterans get cancer. And one of the things also from the liver is fatty livers, that veterans get fatty livers from the liver's trying, working so hard to, you know, try to get that dioxin out. Also, we have a lot of skin problems on us from Agent Orange and from being in the jungles in Vietnam. I have to, all the time, when I go to my doctor, veterans care doctor, she looks at on my back because I have all these horrible things from the war on my back, and they're watching them, and they take some off every now and then. So my doc always takes this picture of my back. So I have on my cell phone, I have a picture of my back, and I have to take pictures of my back, and if I see anything that's really wrong with them, I send her a picture, and I'll go in and they'll look at them and decide what they're going to do with them. But that happens a lot, us guys, from the war in Vietnam. Sam, can you play that next song for me? And that's a really good song, Taking It to the Streets, because this regime that's in Washington right now is taken away and taken away and taken away from us, the people. And like they said in the movie, in the song, that we have to take care of each other. We have to not let them, and I used to have all these talks with Laurel about them, and finally she said, yeah, there is a them, and we have to stick together. We have to really work hard. If we have to go to the streets, we'll go to the streets. We'll go to the ballot box. We'll do everything we can to take care of each other, to our brothers and our sisters. And we have to take care and help our brothers and our sisters around the world. We got to make this country what it's supposed to be, not a pariah in the world, but it's a helping, caring country that will take care of us and will help other people. I know that sounds kind of Pollyannish, but it's possible. You know, you can only put someone in a corner and kick on them for so long before they come out fighting. And that's what's going to happen here, you know. They're trying to take away our sisters' rights for abortions and health care. You know, they're taxing us and taking, you know, our freedoms away and doing it, for causes I don't understand. And, well, I understand and I don't like them. You know, I want free medical care for all of us, you know. Bernie Sanders, you know, has that right. You know, he has it right. And I support Bernie a lot and the things he says, you know, and I listen to him. And I just want everybody to have the same good care that I get at the VA. I want everybody to have that same care. We can't let them divide us. We can't do it. You know, we may have some difference in our ideologies and the way we want things done, but we have to support our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. We have to support our African Americans and Asian Americans and whatever Americans, you know, that they come up with. You know, we have to stick together and make things better for us. I know going in the streets is scary. We've seen it right here in Portland. What the police do to us here in Portland. We'll be back Friday, June, I believe it's on the 15th. Mike should be back by then, and we'll have another great talk with you people. And I firmly, deep within me, I want to thank each and every one of you for keeping us on the air and keeping this radio station, KBOO 90.7, on the air. Because we need this station a lot. We need each other. And I want to thank Sam for being my engineer. And there it is. We'll be back.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me.